Chapter 39 The Captain's Table. It was a pity that viewers on and off Earth could not have enjoyed the less formal discussions aboard Universe. Shipboard life had now settled down to a steady routine, punctuated by a few regular landmarks, of which the most important, and certainly the most long-established, was the captain's table. At 1800 hours exactly, the 6 passengers and 5 of the officers not on duty would join Captain Smith for dinner. There was, of course, none of the formal dress that had been mandatory aboard the floating palaces of the North Atlantic, but there was usually some attempt at sartorial novelty. Eva could always be relied upon to produce some new brooch, ring, necklace, hair ribbon, or perfume from an apparently inexhaustible supply. If the drive was on, the meal would begin with soup, but if the ship was coasting and weightless, there would be a selection of hors d'oeuvres. In either event, before the main course was served, Captain Smith would report the latest news, or try to dispel the latest rumors, usually fueled by newscasts from Earth or Ganymede. Accusations and countercharges were flying in all directions, and the most fantastic theories had been proposed to account for Galaxy's hijacking. A finger had been pointed at every secret organization known to exist, and many that were purely imaginary. All the theories, however, had one thing in common. Not one of them could suggest a plausible motive. The mystery had been compounded by the one fact that had emerged. Strenuous detective work by Astropol had established the surprising fact that the late Rose McMahon was really Ruth Mason, born in North London, recruited to the Metropolitan Police, and then, after a promising start, dismissed for racist activities. She had emigrated to Africa and vanished. Obviously, she had become involved in that unlucky continent's political underground. Shaka was frequently mentioned, and as frequently denied by the USSA. What all this could possibly have to do with Europa was endlessly and fruitlessly debated around the table, especially when Maggie M. confessed that at one time she had been planning a novel about Shaka from the viewpoint of one of the Zulu despot's 1,000 unfortunate wives. But the more she researched the project, the more repellent it became. "By the time I abandoned Shaka," she wryly admitted, "I knew exactly what a modern German feels about Hitler." Such personal revelations became more and more common as the voyage proceeded. When the main meal was over, one of the group would be given the floor for 30 minutes. Between them, they had a dozen lifetimes of experience on as many heavenly bodies, so it would be hard to find a better source of after-dinner tales. The least effective speaker was, somewhat surprisingly, Victor Willis. He was frank enough to admit it, and to give the reason. "I'm so used," he said, almost but not quite apologetically, "to performing for an audience of millions that I find it hard to interact with a friendly little group like this." "Could you do better if it wasn't friendly?" asked Mihailovich, always anxious to be helpful. "That could be easily arranged." Eva, on the other hand, turned out to be better than expected, even though her memories were confined entirely to the world of entertainment. She was particularly good on the famous and infamous directors she had worked with, especially David Griffin. "Was it true," asked Maggie M., doubtless thinking of Shaka, "that he hated women?" "Not at all," Eva answered promptly. "He just hated actors. He didn't believe they were human beings." Mihailovich's reminiscences also covered a somewhat limited territory. The great orchestras and ballet companies, famous conductors and composers, and their innumerable hangers-on. But he was so full of hilarious stories of backstage intrigues and liaisons, and accounts of sabotaged first nights and mortal feuds among prima donnas, that he kept even his most unmusical listeners convulsed with laughter, and was willingly granted extra time. Colonel Greenberg's matter-of-fact accounts of extraordinary events could hardly have provided a greater contrast. The first landing at Mercury's relatively temperate South Pole had been so thoroughly reported that there was little new to be said about it. The question that interested everyone was, "When will we return?" That was usually followed by, "Would you like to go back?" If they ask me to. Of course I'll go, Greenberg answered. But I rather think that Mercury is going to be like the moon. Remember, we landed there in 1969 and didn't go back again for half a lifetime. Anyway, Mercury isn't as useful as the moon, though perhaps one day it may be. There's no water there. Of course, it was quite a surprise to find any on the moon. Or I should say, in the moon. Though it wasn't as glamorous as landing on Mercury, I did a more important job setting up the Aristarchus mule train. Mule train? Yep. Before the big equatorial launcher was built and they started shooting the ice straight into orbit, we had to haul it from the pithead to the Imbrium spaceport. That meant leveling a road across the lava plains and bridging quite a few crevasses. The ice road, we called it. Only 300 kilometers, but it took several lives to build. The mules were 8-wheeled tractors with huge tires and independent suspension. They towed up to a dozen trailers with 100 tons of ice apiece. Used to travel by night. No need to shield the cargo then. I rode with them several times. The trip took about 6 hours. We weren't out to break speed records. Then the ice would be offloaded into big pressurized tanks waiting for sunrise. As soon as it melted, it would be pumped into the ships. The ice road is still there, of course, but only the tourists use it now. If they're sensible, they'll drive by night as we used to do. It was pure magic, with the full Earth almost directly overhead, so brilliant that we seldom used our own lights. And although we could talk to our friends whenever we wanted to, we often switched off the radio and left it to the automatics to tell them we were okay. We just wanted to be alone in that great shining emptiness while it was still there, because we knew it wouldn't last. Now they're building the TerraVolt Quark Smasher, running right around the equator, and domes are going up all over Imbrium and Serenitatis. But we knew the real lunar wilderness, exactly as Armstrong and Aldrin saw it, before you could buy wish-you-were-here cards in the post office at Tranquility Base. Chapter 40 Monsters from Earth. Lucky you missed the annual ball. Believe it or not, it was just as grisly as last year's. And once again, our resident mastodon, dear Ms. Wilkinson, managed to crush her partner's toes, even on the half-G dance floor. Now, some business. Since you won't be back for months instead of a couple of weeks, admin is looking lustfully at your apartment. Good neighborhood, near downtown shopping area, splendid view of Earth on clear days, etc., etc., and suggesting a sublet until you return. Seems a good deal and will save you a lot of money. We'll collect any personal effects you'd like stored. Now this Shaka business. We know you love pulling our legs, but frankly, Jerry and I were horrified. I can see why Maggie M. turned him down. Yes, of course, we've read her Olympic lusts. Very enjoyable, but too feminist for us. What a monster. I can understand why they've called a gang of African terrorists after him. Fancy executing his warriors if they got married, and killing all the poor cows in his wretched empire just because they were female. Worst of all, those horrid spears he invented. Shocking manners, jabbing them into people you've not been properly introduced to. And what a ghastly advertisement for us Fays. Almost enough to make one want to switch. We've always claimed that we're gentle and kind-hearted, as well as madly talented and artistic, of course, but now you've made us look into some of the so-called great warriors. As if there was anything great about killing people, we're almost ashamed of the company we've been keeping. Yes, we did know about Hadrian and Alexander, but we certainly didn't know about Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, or Julius Caesar, though he was everything, ask Anthony as well as Cleo, or Frederick the Great, who does have some redeeming features. Look how he treated old Bach. When I told Jerry that at least Napoleon is an exception, we don't have to be saddled with him, do you know what he said? I bet Josephine was really a boy. Try that on Eva. You've ruined our morale, you rascal, tarring us with that blood-stained brush. Sorry about the mixed metaphor. You should have left us in happy ignorance. Despite that, we send our love, and so does Sebastian. Say hello to any Europans you meet. Judging by the reports from Galaxy, some of them would make very good partners for Ms. Wilkinson. Chapter 41 Memoirs of a Centenarian. Dr. Heywood Floyd preferred not to talk about the first mission to Jupiter and the second to Lucifer 10 years later. It was all so long ago, and there was nothing he had not said 100 times to congressional committees, space council boards, and media persons like Victor Willis. Nevertheless, he had a duty to his fellow passengers that could not be avoided. As the only living man to have witnessed the birth of a new sun and a new solar system, they expected him to have some special understanding of the worlds they were now so swiftly approaching. It was a naive assumption. He could tell them far less about the Galilean satellites than the scientists and engineers who had been working there for more than a generation. When he was asked, "What's it really like on Europa, or Ganymede, or Io, or Callisto?" he was liable to refer the inquirer, rather brusquely, to the voluminous reports available in the ship's library. Yet there was one area where his experience was unique. Half a century later, he sometimes wondered if it had really happened, or whether he had been asleep aboard Discovery, when David Bowman had appeared to him. Almost easier to believe that a spaceship could be haunted. But he could not have been dreaming when the floating dust motes assembled themselves into that ghostly image of a man who should have been dead for 12 years. Without the warning it had given him, how clearly he remembered that its lips were motionless, and the voice had come from the console speaker. Leonov and all aboard would have been vaporized in the detonation of Jupiter. "Why did he do it?" Floyd answered during one of the after-dinner sessions. "I've puzzled over that for 50 years. Whatever he became, after he went out in Discovery's space pod to investigate the monolith, he must still have had some links with the human race. He was not completely alien. We know that he returned to Earth, briefly, because of that orbiting bomb incident, and there's strong evidence that he visited both his mother and his old girlfriend. That's not the action of an entity that had discarded all emotions." "What do you suppose he is now?" asked Willis. "For that matter, where is he?"
"Perhaps that last question has no meaning, even for human beings. Do you know where your consciousness resides?"
"I've no use for metaphysics. Somewhere in the general area of my brain, anyway."
"When I was a young man," sighed Mihailovich, who had a talent for deflating the most serious discussions, "mine was about 1 meter lower down."
"Let's assume he's on Europa. We know there's a monolith there, and Bowman was certainly associated with it in some way. See how he relayed that warning."
"Do you think he also relayed the second one, telling us to stay away?"
"Which we are now going to ignore.
In a good cause."
Captain Smith, who was usually content to let the discussion go where it wished, made one of his rare interjections. "Dr. Floyd," he said thoughtfully, "you're in a unique position, and we should take advantage of it. Bowman went out of his way to help you once. If he's still around, he may be willing to do so again. I worry a good deal about that 'attempt no landings here' order. If he could assure us that it was temporarily suspended, let's say, I'd be much happier." There were several hear-hears around the table before Floyd answered. "Yes, I've been thinking along the same lines. I've already told Galaxy to watch out for any, let's say, manifestations, in case he tries to make contact."
"Of course," said Eva, "he may be dead by now, if ghosts can die."
Not even Mihailovich had a suitable comment to this, but Eva obviously sensed that no one thought much of her contribution.
Undeterred, she tried again.
Woody, dear, she said, why don't you simply give him a call on the radio? That's what it's for, isn't it?
The idea had occurred to Floyd, but it had somehow seemed too naive to take seriously.
I will, he said. I don't suppose it will do any harm.
Chapter 42 Minilith.
This time, Floyd was quite sure he was dreaming. He had never been able to sleep well in zero gravity, and the universe was now coasting, unpowered, at maximum velocity. In 2 days, it would start almost a week of steady deceleration, throwing away its enormous excess speed until it was able to rendezvous with Europa. However many times he adjusted the restraining straps, they always seemed either too tight or too loose. He would have difficulty in breathing, or else he would find himself drifting out of his bunk. Once he had awoken in midair and had flailed away for several minutes until, exhausted, he had managed to swim the few meters to the nearest wall. Not until then had he remembered that he should merely have waited. The room ventilating system would have soon pulled him to the exhaust grill without any exertion on his part. As a seasoned space traveler, he knew this perfectly well. His only excuse was simple panic. But tonight, he had managed to get everything right. Probably when weight returned, he would have difficulty in readjusting to that. He had lain awake for only a few minutes, recapitulating the latest discussion at dinner, and had then fallen asleep. In his dreams, he had continued the conversation around the table. There had been a few trifling changes, which he accepted without surprise. Willis, for example, had grown his beard back, though on only one side of his face. This, Floyd presumed, was in aid of some research project, though he found it difficult to imagine its purpose. In any event, he had his own worries. He was defending himself against the criticisms of Space Administrator Milson, who had somewhat surprisingly joined their little group. Floyd wondered how he had come aboard Universe. Could he possibly have stowed away? The fact that Milson had been dead for at least 40 years seemed much less important. Heywood, his old enemy, was saying, the White House is most upset. I can't imagine why. That radio message you've just sent to Europa, did it have State Department clearance? I didn't think it was necessary. I merely asked permission to land. Ah, but that's it. Who did you ask? Do we recognize the government concerned? I'm afraid it's all very irregular. Milson faded away, still tut-tutting. I'm very glad this is only a dream, thought Floyd. Now what? Well, I might have expected it. Hello, old friend. You come in all sizes, don't you? Of course, even TMA-1 couldn't have squeezed into my cabin. And its big brother could easily have swallowed Universe in one gulp. The black monolith was standing, or floating, only 2 meters from his bunk. With an uncomfortable shock of recognition, Floyd realized that it was not only the same shape, but also the same size as an ordinary tombstone. Although the resemblance had often been pointed out to him, until now the incongruity of scale had lessened the psychological impact. Now, for the first time, he felt the likeness was disquieting, even sinister. I know this is only a dream, but at my age, I don't want any reminders. Anyway, what are you doing here? Do you bring a message from Dave Bowman? Are you Dave Bowman? Well, I didn't really expect an answer. You weren't very talkative in the past, were you? But things always happened when you were around. Back in Tycho, 60 years ago, you sent that signal to Jupiter to tell your makers that we'd dug you up. And look what you did to Jupiter when we got there 12 years later. What are you up to now?
Part 6 Haven. Chapter 43. Salvage. The first task confronting Captain Laplace and his crew, once they had grown accustomed to being on terra firma, was to reorient themselves. Everything on Galaxy was the wrong way around. Spaceships are designed for two modes of operation, either no gravity at all, or when the engines are thrusting, an up-and-down direction along the axis. But now Galaxy was lying almost horizontally, and all the floors had become walls. It was exactly as if they were trying to live in a lighthouse that had toppled onto its side. Every single piece of furniture had to be moved, and at least 50% of the equipment was not functioning properly. Yet in some ways this was a blessing in disguise, and Captain Laplace made the most of it. The crew was so busy rearranging Galaxy's interior, giving priority to the plumbing, that he had few worries about morale. As long as the hull remained airtight and the muon generators continued to supply power, they were in no immediate danger. They merely had to survive for 20 days, and salvation would come from the skies in the shape of universe. No one ever mentioned the possibility that the unknown powers that ruled Europa might object to a second landing. They had, as far as anyone knew, ignored the first. Surely they would not interfere with a mission of mercy. Europa itself, however, was now less cooperative. While Galaxy had been adrift on the open sea, it had been virtually unaffected by the quakes that continually racked the little world. But now that the ship had become an all-too-permanent land structure, it was shaken every few hours by seismic disturbances. Had it touched down in the normal vertical position, by now it would certainly have been overturned. The quakes were unpleasant rather than dangerous, but they gave nightmares to anyone who had experienced Tokyo 33 or Los Angeles 45. It did not help much to know that they followed a completely predictable pattern, rising to a peak of violence and frequency every 3.5 days when Io came swinging past on its inner orbit. Nor was it much consolation to know that Europa's own gravitational tides were inflicting at least equal damage on Io. After 6 days of grueling work, Captain Laplace was satisfied that Galaxy was as near ship-shape as was possible in the circumstances. He declared a holiday, which most of the crew spent sleeping, and then drew up a schedule for their second week on the satellite. The scientists, of course, wanted to explore the new world they had so unexpectedly entered. According to the radar maps that Ganymede had transmitted to them, the island was 15 kilometers long and 5 wide. Its maximum elevation was only 100 meters, not high enough, someone had gloomily predicted, to avoid a really bad tsunami. It was hard to imagine a more dismal and forbidding place. Half a century of exposure to Europa's feeble winds and rains had done nothing to break up the pillow lava that covered half its surface, or to soften the outcropping of granite that protruded through the rivers of frozen rock. But it was their home now, and they had to find a name for it. Gloomy, downbeat suggestions like Hades, Inferno, Hell, Purgatory were firmly vetoed by the captain. He wanted something cheerful. One surprising and quixotic tribute to a brave enemy was seriously considered before being rejected 32-10 with 5 abstentions. The island would not be called Roseland. In the end, Haven won, unanimously. Chapter 44. Endurance. History never repeats itself, but historical situations recur. As he made his daily report to Ganymede, Captain Laplace kept thinking of that phrase. It had been quoted by Margaret Mbala, now approaching at almost 1,000 kilometers every second, in a message of encouragement from Universe that he had been very happy to relay to his fellow castaways. Please tell Miss Mbala that her little history lesson was extremely good for morale. She couldn't have thought of anything better to send us. Despite the inconvenience of having our walls and floors switched around, we're living in luxury compared to those old polar explorers. Some of us had heard of Ernest Shackleton, but we had no idea of the Endurance saga.
to have been trapped on ice floes for over a year, then to spend the Antarctic winter in a cave, then to cross 1,000 kilometers of sea in an open boat, and to climb a range of unmapped mountains to reach the nearest human settlement. And yet that was only the beginning. What we find incredible and inspiring is that Shackleton went back 4 times to rescue his men on that little island and saved every one of them. You can guess what that story's done to our spirits. I hope you can fax his book to us in your next transmission. We're all anxious to read it. And what would he have thought of that? Yes, we're infinitely better off than any of those old-time explorers. It's almost impossible to believe that until well into the last century, they were completely cut off from the rest of the human race once they'd gone over the horizon. We should be ashamed at grumbling because light isn't fast enough and we can't talk to our friends in real time, or that it takes a couple of hours to get replies from Earth. They had no contact for months, almost years. Again, Miss M'Bala, our sincerest thanks. Of course, all Earth explorers did have one considerable advantage over us. At least they could breathe the air. Our science team has been clamoring to go outside, and we've modified 4 spacesuits for EVAs of up to 6 hours. At this atmospheric pressure, they won't need full suits. A waist seal is good enough, and I'm allowing 2 men to go out at a time as long as they stay within sight of the ship. Finally, here's today's weather report. Pressure 250 bars, temperature steady at 25 degrees, wind gusting at up to 30 clicks from the west, usual 100% overcast, quakes between 1 and 3 on open-ended Richter. You know, I never did like the sound of that open-ended, especially now that Io's coming into conjunction again. Chapter 45 Mission. When people asked to see him together, it usually meant trouble, or at least some difficult decision. Captain Laplace had noticed that Floyd and Vandenberg were spending a lot of time in earnest discussions, often with Second Officer Chang, and it was easy to guess what they were talking about. Yet their proposal still took him by surprise. "You want to go to Mount Zeus? How? In an open boat? Has that Shackleton book gone to your head?" Floyd looked slightly embarrassed. The captain was right on target. South had been an inspiration, in more ways than one. "Even if we could build a boat, sir, it would take much too long, especially now that Universe looks like reaching us within 10 days. "And I'm not sure," added Vandenberg, "that I'd care to sail on this Sea of Galilee. Not all its inhabitants may have got the message that we're inedible." "So that leaves only one alternative, doesn't it?" "I'm skeptical, but I'm willing to be convinced. Go on." "We've discussed it with Mr. Chang, and he confirms that it can be done. Mount Zeus is only 300 kilometers away. The shuttle can fly there in less than an hour." "And find a place to land? As you doubtless recall, Mr. Chang wasn't very successful with Universe." "No problem, sir. The William Song's only 1/100 of our mass. Even that ice could probably have supported it. We've been over the video records and found 12 good landing sites." "Besides," said Vandenberg, "the pilot won't have a pistol pointed at him. That could help." "I'm sure it will. But the big problem is at this end. How are you going to get the shuttle out of its garage? Can you rig a crane? Even in this gravity, it would be quite a load."
"No need to, sir. Mr. Chang can fly it out."
There was a prolonged silence while Captain Laplace contemplated, obviously without much enthusiasm, the idea of rocket motors firing inside his ship. The small 100-ton shuttle William Sung, more familiarly known as Bill T, was designed purely for orbital operations. Normally, it would be pushed gently out of its garage, and the engines would not operate until it was well away from the mothership. "Obviously, you've worked all this out," said the captain grudgingly. "But what about the angle of takeoff? Don't tell me you want to roll Universe over so that Bill T can pop straight up.
The garage is halfway down one side. Lucky it wasn't underneath when we grounded. The takeoff will have to be at 60 degrees to the horizontal. The lateral thrusters can handle it. If Mr. Chang says so, I'll certainly believe him. But what will the firing do to the ship? Well, it will wreck the garage interior, but it will never be used again anyway. And the bulkheads are designed for accidental explosions, so there's no danger of damage to the rest of the ship. We'll have firefighting crews standing by just in case. It was a brilliant concept, no doubt of that. If it worked, the mission would not be a total failure. During the last week, Captain Laplace had given scarcely a moment's thought to the mystery of Mount Zeus, which had brought them to this predicament. Only survival had mattered. But now, there was hope, and leisure to think ahead. It would be worth taking some risks to find why this little world was the focus of so much intrigue. Chapter 46 Shuttle.
Speaking from memory, said Dr. Anderson, Goddard's first rocket flew about 50 meters. I wonder if Mr. Chang will beat that record.
He'd better, or we'll all be in trouble. Most of the science team had gathered in the observation lounge, and everyone was staring anxiously back along the hull of the ship. Although the entrance of the garage was not visible from this angle, they would see the Bill T soon enough when, and if, it emerged. There was no countdown. Chang was taking his time, making every possible check, and would fire when he felt like it. The shuttle had been stripped down to its minimum mass and was carrying just enough propellant for 100 seconds of flight. If everything worked, that would be ample. If it didn't, more would not only be superfluous, but dangerous.
Here we go, said Chang casually.
It was almost like a conjuring trick. Everything happened so quickly that the eye was deceived. No one saw Bill T pop out of the garage because it was hidden in a cloud of steam. When the cloud had cleared, the shuttle was already landing, 200 meters away. A great cheer of relief echoed through the lounge.
He did it, cried X, acting Captain Lee. He's broken Goddard's record, easily.
Standing on its four stubby legs in the bleak European landscape, Bill T looked like a larger and even less elegant version of an Apollo lunar module. That was not, however, the thought that occurred to Captain Laplace as he looked out from the bridge. It seemed to him that his ship was rather like a stranded whale that had managed a difficult birth in an alien element. He hoped that the new calf would survive. 48 very busy hours later, the William Sung was loaded, checked out on a 10-kilometer circuit over the island, and ready to go. There was still plenty of time for the mission. By the most optimistic reckoning, Universe could not arrive for another 3 days, and the trip to Mount Zeus, even allowing for the deployment of Dr. Vandenberg's extensive array of instruments, would take only 6 hours. As soon as Second Officer Chang had landed, Captain Laplace called him to his cabin. The skipper looked, thought Chang, somewhat ill at ease.
Good work, Walter. But of course that's only what we expect.
Thanks, sir.
So what's the problem?
The captain smiled. A well-integrated crew could keep no secrets.
Head office, as usual. I hate to disappoint you, but I've had orders that only Dr. Vandenberg and Second Officer Floyd are to make the trip.
I get the picture. Chang answered, with a trace of bitterness. What have you told them?
Nothing yet. That's why I wanted to talk to you. I'm quite prepared to say that you're the only pilot who can fly the mission.
They'll know that's nonsense. Floyd could do the job as well as I can. There's not the slightest risk, except for a malfunction which could happen to anyone.
I'd still be willing to stick my neck out if you insist. After all, no one can stop me. And we'll all be heroes when we get back to Earth.
Chang was obviously doing some intricate calculations. He seemed rather pleased with the result.
Replacing a couple of 100 kilos of payload with propellant gives us an interesting new option. I'd intended to mention it earlier, But there was no way Bill T could manage with all that extra gear and a full crew.
Don't tell me. The Great Wall.
Of course. We could do a complete survey in one or two passes and find what it really is.
I thought we had a very good idea, and I'm not sure if we should go near it. That might be pressing our luck.
Perhaps. But there's another reason. To some of us, it's an even better one.
Go on.
Cien. It's only 10 kilometers from the wall. We'd like to drop a wreath there.
So that was what his officers had been discussing so solemnly. Not for the first time. Captain Laplace wished he knew a little more Mandarin.
I understand, he said quietly. I'll have to think it over. And talk to Vanderberg and Floyd to see if they agree.
And head office?
No, damn it. This will be my decision.
Chapter 47 Shards.
You'd better hurry, Ganymede Central had advised. The next conjunction will be a bad one. We'll be triggering quakes as well as Io. And we don't want to scare you, but unless our radar's gone crazy, your mountain's sunk another 100 meters since the last check.
At that rate, thought Vanderberg, Europa will be flat again in 10 years. How much faster things happened here than on Earth, which was one reason why the place was so popular with geologists. Now that he was strapped into the number two position immediately behind Floyd and virtually surrounded by consoles of his own equipment, he felt a curious mixture of excitement and regret. In a few hours, the great intellectual adventure of his life would be over, one way or the other. Nothing that would ever happen again could possibly match it. He did not have the slightest trace of fear. His confidence in both man and machine was complete. One unexpected emotion was a wry sense of gratitude to the late Rose McMahon. Without her, he would never have had this opportunity, but might have gone, still uncertain, to his grave. The heavily laden Bill T could barely manage 1/10 of a gravity at liftoff. It was not intended for this sort of work, but would manage much better on the homeward journey when it had deposited its cargo. It seemed to take ages to climb clear of Galaxy, and they had ample time to note the damage to the hull as well as signs of corrosion from the occasional mildly acid rains. While Floyd concentrated on the liftoff, Vanderberg gave a quick report on the ship's condition from the viewpoint of a privileged observer. It seemed the right thing to do. Even though, with any luck, Galaxy's spaceworthiness would soon be of no further concern to anyone. Now they could see the whole of Haven spread out beneath them, and Vanderberg realized what a brilliant job Acting Captain Lee had done when he beached the ship. There were only a few places where it could have been safely grounded. Although a good deal of luck had also been involved, Lee had used wind and sea anchor to the best possible advantage. The mists closed around them. Bill T was rising on a semi-ballistic trajectory to minimize drag, and there would be nothing to see except clouds for 20 minutes. A pity, thought Vanderberg. I'm sure there must be some interesting creatures swimming around down there, and no one else may ever have a chance of seeing them.
Coming up to engine cutoff, said Floyd. Everything nominal. Very good, Bill T. No report of traffic at your altitude. You're still number one on the runway to land.
Who's that joker? Asked Vanderberg.
Ronnie Lim. Believe it or not, that number one on the runway goes back to Apollo. Vanderberg could understand why. There was nothing like the occasional touch of humor, providing it was not overdone, to relieve the strain when men were involved in some complex and possibly hazardous enterprise.
15 minutes before we start breaking, said Floyd. Let's see who else is on the air.
He started the auto scan, and a succession of beeps and whistles, separated by short silences as the tuner rejected them one by one in its swift climb up the radio spectrum, echoed round the little cabin.
Your local beacons and data transmissions, said Floyd.
I was hoping...
Ah, here we are. It was only a faint musical tone, warbling rapidly up and down like a demented soprano. Floyd glanced at the frequency meter. Doppler shift almost gone. She's slowing fast.
What is it?
Text? Slow scan video, I think. They're relaying a lot of material back to Earth through the big dish on Ganymede, when it's in the right position. The networks are yelling for news. They listened to the hypnotic but meaningless sound for a few minutes. Then Floyd switched it off. Incomprehensible though the transmission from Universe was to their unaided senses, it conveyed the only message that mattered. Help was on the way, and would soon be there. Partly to fill the silence, but also because he was genuinely interested, Vandenberg remarked casually, "Have you talked to your grandfather lately?" Talked, of course, was a misnomer where interplanetary distances were concerned, but no one had come up with an acceptable alternative. Voicegram, audio mail, and vocard had all flourished briefly, then vanished into limbo. Even now, most of the human race probably did not believe that real-time conversation was impossible in the solar system's wide open spaces, and from time to time indignant protests were heard. Why can't you scientists do something about it?
Yes, said Floyd. He's in fine shape, and I look forward to meeting him.
There was a slight strain in his voice.
I wonder, thought Vandenberg, when they last met.
But he realized that it would be tactless to ask. Instead, he spent the next 10 minutes rehearsing the offloading and setting up procedures with Floyd, so there would be no unnecessary confusion when they touched down. The commence braking alarm went off just a fraction of a second after Floyd had already started the program sequencer. I'm in good hands, thought Vandenberg. I can relax and concentrate on my job. Where's that camera? Don't say it's floated away again. The clouds were clearing. Even though the radar had shown exactly what was beneath them, in a display as good as normal vision could provide, it was still a shock to see the face of the mountain rearing up only a few kilometers ahead.
Look, cried Floyd suddenly. Over to the left, by that double peak. Give you one guess. I'm sure you're right. I don't think we did any damage. It just splattered. Wonder where the other one hit.
Altitude 1,000. Which landing site? Alpha doesn't look so good from here.
You're right. Try Gamma. Closer to the mountain, anyway.
500. Gamma it is. I'll hover for 20 secs. If you don't like it, we'll switch to Beta. 400. 300. 200. Good luck, Bill T, said Galaxy briefly. Thanks, Ronnie. 150. 100. 50. How about it? Just a few small rocks and... That's peculiar. What looks like broken glass all over the place. Someone's had a wild party here. 50. 50. Still okay?
Perfect. Go down.
40. 30. 20. 10. Sure you don't want to change your mind? 10. Kicking up a little dust, as Neil said once. Or was it Buzz? 5. Contact. Easy, wasn't it? Don't know why they bother to pay me. Chapter 48. Lucy.
Hello, Ganny Central. We've made a perfect landing. I mean, Chris has, on a flat surface of some metamorphic rock. Probably the same pseudo-granite we've called Havenite. The base of the mountain is only 2 kilometers away, but already I can tell there's no real need to go any closer. We're putting on our top suits now, and we'll start unloading in 5 minutes. We'll leave the monitors running, of course, and we'll call on every quarter hour. Van out.
What did you mean by that, no need to go any closer? Asked Floyd. Vandenberg grinned. In the last few minutes he seemed to have shed years and almost to have become a carefree boy.
Kirkomspica, he said happily. Latin for look around you.
Let's get the big camera out first. Wow!
The Bill T gave a sudden lurch, and for a moment heaved up and down on its landing gear shock absorbers with a motion that, if it had continued for more than a few seconds, would have been a recipe for an instant seasickness.
Ganymede was right about those quakes, said Floyd, when they had recovered. Is there any serious danger?
Probably not. It's still 30 hours to conjunction, and this looks a solid slab of rock. But we won't waste any time here. Luckily, we won't need to. Is my mask straight? It doesn't feel right.
Let me tighten the strap. That's better. Breathe in hard. Good, now it fits fine. I'll go out first.
Vandenberg wished that his could be that first small step, but Floyd was the commander, and it was his duty to check that the Bill T was in good shape and ready for an immediate takeoff. He walked once around the little spacecraft, examining the landing gear, then gave the thumbs-up signal to Vandenberg, who started down the ladder to join him. Although he had worn the same lightweight breathing equipment on his exploration of Haven, he felt a little awkward with it and paused at the landing pad to make some adjustments. Then he glanced up and saw what Floyd was doing.
"Don't touch it," he cried. "It's dangerous."
Floyd jumped a good meter away from the shards of vitreous rock he was examining. To his untrained eye, they looked rather like an unsuccessful melt from a large glass furnace.
"It's not radioactive, is it?" he asked anxiously.
"No, but stay away until I've got there."
To his surprise, Floyd realized that Vandenberg was wearing heavy gloves. As a space officer, it had taken Floyd a long time to grow accustomed to the fact that here on Europa, it was safe to expose one's bare skin to the atmosphere. Nowhere else in the solar system, even on Mars, was that possible. Very cautiously, Vandenberg reached down and picked up a long splinter of the glassy material. Even in this diffused light, it glittered strangely, and Floyd could see that it had a vicious cutting edge.
"The sharpest knife in the known universe," said Vandenberg happily.
"We've been through all this to find a knife?"
Vandenberg started to laugh, then found it wasn't easy inside his mask.
"So you still don't know what this is about?"
"I'm beginning to feel I'm the only one who doesn't."
Vandenberg took his companion by the shoulder and turned him to face the looming mass of Mount Zeus. From this distance, it filled half the sky, not merely the greatest, but the only mountain on this whole world.
"Admire the view, just for 1 minute. I have an important call to make."
He punched a code sequence on his comm set, waited for the ready light to flash, and said,
"Ganymede Central 109, this is Van. Do you receive?"
After no more than the minimum time lag, an obviously electronic voice answered.
"Hello, Van. This is Ganymede Central 109. Ready to receive."
Vandenberg paused, savoring the moment he would remember for the rest of his life.
"Contact Earth, indent Uncle 737. Relay following message. Lucy is here. Lucy is here. End message. Please repeat."
Perhaps I should have stopped him saying that, whatever it means, thought Floyd, as Ganymede repeated the message. But it's too late now. It will reach Earth within the hour.
"Sorry about that, Chris,"
Vandenberg grinned. "I wanted to establish priority, amongst other things.
Unless you start talking soon, I'll begin carving you up with one of these patent glass knives."
"Glass, indeed. Well, the explanation can wait. It's absolutely fascinating, but quite complicated. So I'll give you the straight facts. Mount Zeus is a single diamond, approximate mass 1,000,000,000 tons. Or, if you prefer it that way, about 2 × 10⁻¹⁷ carats. But I can't guarantee that it's all gem quality."
Part 7. The Great Wall. Chapter 49. Shrine. As they unloaded the equipment from Bill T and set it up on their little granite landing pad,
Chris Floyd found it hard to tear his eyes away from the mountain looming above them. A single diamond, bigger than Everest. Why, the scattered fragments lying round the shuttle must be worth billions rather than millions. On the other hand, they might be worth no more than, well, scraps of broken glass. The value of diamonds had always been controlled by the dealers and producers, but if a literal gem mountain came suddenly on the market, prices would obviously collapse completely. Now Floyd began to understand why so many interested parties had focused their attention upon Europa. The political and economic ramifications were endless. Now that he had at least proved his theory, Vandenberg had become again the dedicated and single-minded scientist, anxious to complete his experiment with no further distraction. With Floyd's help, it was not easy to get some of the bulkier pieces of equipment out of Bill T's cramped cabin. They first drilled the meter-long core with a portable electric drill and carried it carefully back to the shuttle. Floyd would have had a different set of priorities, but he recognized that it made sense to do the harder tasks first. Not until they had laid out a seismograph array and erected a panoramic TV camera on a low, heavy tripod did Vandenberg condescend to collect some of the incomputable riches lying all around them. "At the very least," he said, as he carefully selected some of the less lethal fragments, "they'll make good souvenirs. Unless Rosie's friends murder us to get them." Vandenberg looked sharply at his companion. He wondered how much Chris really knew, and how much, like all of them, he was guessing. "Not worth their while, now that the secret's out. In about an hour's time, the stock exchange computers will be going crazy." "You bastard," said Floyd, with admiration rather than rancor. "So that's what your message was about. There is no law that says a scientist shouldn't make a little profit on the side. But I'm leaving the sordid details to my friends on Earth. Honestly, I'm much more interested in the job we're doing here. Let me have that wrench, please." 3 times before they had finished establishing Zeus Station, they were almost knocked off their feet by quakes. They could feel them first as a vibration underfoot, then everything would start shaking. Then there would be a horrible, long-drawn-out groaning sound that seemed to come from every direction. It was even airborne, which to Floyd seemed strangest of all. He could not quite get used to the fact that there was enough atmosphere around them to allow short-range conversations without radio. Vandenberg kept assuring him that the quakes were still quite harmless, but Floyd had learned never to put too much trust in experts. True, the geologist had just been proved spectacularly right. As he looked at Bill T heaving on its shock absorbers like a storm-tossed ship, Floyd hoped that Van's luck would hold for at least a few more minutes. "It seems to be it," said the scientist at last, to Floyd's great relief. "Ganymede's getting good data on all channels. The batteries will last for years, with the solar panel to keep recharging them. If this gear is still standing a week from now, I'll be very surprised. I'll swear that mountain's moved since we landed. Let's get off before it falls on top of us." "I'm more worried," Vandenberg said with a laugh, "that your jet blast will undo all our work." "No risk of that. We're well clear, and now we've offloaded so much junk we'll need only half power to lift. Unless you want to take aboard a few more billions, or trillions." "Let's not be greedy. Anyway, I can't even guess what this will be worth when we get it to Earth. The museums will grab most of it, of course. After that, who knows?" Floyd's fingers were flying over the control panel as he exchanged messages with Galaxy. First stage of mission completed. Bill T ready for takeoff. Flight plan as agreed. They were not surprised when Captain Laplace answered. "You're quite certain you want to go ahead. Remember, you have the final decision. I'll back you up, whatever it is." "Yes, sir, we're both happy. We understand how the crew feels, and the scientific payoff could be enormous. We're both very excited." "Just a minute. We're still waiting for your report on Mount Zeus." Floyd looked at Vandenberg, who shrugged his shoulders, and then took the microphone. "If we told you now, Captain, you'd think we were crazy, or pulling your leg.
Please wait a couple of hours until we're back, with the evidence.
Not much point giving you an order, is it? Anyway, good luck. And from the owner as well. He thinks going to CN is a splendid idea.
I knew Sir Lawrence would approve, Floyd remarked to his companion. And anyway, with Galaxy already a total loss, Bill T's not much extra risk, is it?
Vandenberg could see his point of view, even though he did not entirely subscribe to it. He had made his scientific reputation, but he still looked forward to enjoying it.
Oh, by the way, Floyd said, who was Lucy? Anybody in particular?
Not as far as I know. We came across her in a computer search and decided the name would make a good code word. Everyone would assume it was something to do with Lucifer, which is just enough of a half-truth to be beautifully misleading. I'd never heard of them, but 100 years ago there was a group of popular musicians with a very strange name, the Beatles, spelled B-E-A-T-L-E-S, don't ask me why, and they wrote a song with an equally strange title, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Weird, isn't it? Almost as if they knew.
According to Ganymede radar, the wreck of the Cien lay 300 kilometers west of Mount Zeus, toward the so-called Twilight Zone and the cold lands beyond. Permanently cold they were, but not dark. Half the time they were brilliantly lit by the distant sun. However, even by the end of the long European solar day, the temperature was still far below freezing point. As liquid water could exist only on the hemisphere facing Lucifer, the intermediate region was a place of continual storms, where rain and hail, sleet and snow contended for supremacy. During the half-century since Cien's disastrous landing, the ship had moved almost 1,000 kilometers. It must have drifted, like Galaxy, for several years on the newly created Sea of Galilee, before coming to rest on its bleakly inhospitable shore. Floyd picked up the radar echo as soon as Bill T flattened out at the end of its second leap across Europa. The signal was surprisingly weak for so large an object. As soon as they broke through the clouds, they realized why. The wreck of the spaceship Cien, first man-carrying vessel to land on a satellite of Jupiter, stood in the center of a small circular lake, obviously artificial, and connected by a canal to the sea less than 3 kilometers away. Only the skeleton was left, and not even all of that. The carcass had been picked clean. But by what? Vandenberg asked himself. There was no sign of life there. The place looked as if it had been deserted for years. Yet he had not the slightest doubt that something had stripped the wreck, with deliberate and indeed almost surgical precision.
Obviously safe to land, said Floyd, waiting for a few seconds to get Vandenberg's almost absent-minded nod of approval. The geologist was already videoing everything in sight. Bill T settled down effortlessly by the side of the pool, and they looked across the cold, dark water at this monument to man's exploring impulses. There seemed no convenient way of getting to the wreck, but that did not really matter. When they had suited up, they carried the wreath to the water's edge, held it solemnly for a moment in front of the camera, then tossed in this tribute from Galaxy's crew. It had been beautifully made. Even though the only raw materials available were metal foil, paper, and plastic, one could easily believe that the flowers and leaves were real. Pinned all over them were notes and inscriptions, many written in the ancient but now officially obsolete script rather than Roman characters. As they were walking back to the Bill T, Floyd said thoughtfully, "Did you notice there was practically no metal left? Only glass, plastics, synthetics. What about those ribs and supporting girders?"
"Composite. Mostly carbon, boron.
Someone round here is very hungry for metal, and knows it when it sees it."
"Interesting."
"Very," thought Vandenberg. "On a world where fire could not exist, metals and alloys would be almost impossible to make, and as precious as, well, diamonds."
When Floyd had reported to base and received a message of gratitude from Second Officer Chang and his colleagues, he took the Bill-T up to 1,000 meters and continued westward. "Last lap," he said. "No point in going higher. We'll be there in 10 minutes. But I won't land. If the Great Wall is what we think it is, I'd prefer not to. We'll do a quick flyby and head for home. Get those cameras ready. This could be even more important than Mount Zeus. And," he added to himself, "I may soon know what Grandfather Haywood felt not so far from here, 50 years ago. We'll have a lot to talk about when we meet, less than a week from now, if all goes well." Chapter 50 Open City. What a terrible place, thought Chris Floyd. Nothing but driving sleet, flurries of snow, occasional glimpses of landscapes streaked with ice. Why, Haven was a tropical paradise in comparison. Yet he knew that Nightside, only a few 100 kilometers farther on round the curve of Europa, was even worse. To his surprise, the weather cleared suddenly and completely just before they reached their goal. The clouds lifted, and there ahead was an immense black wall, almost 1 kilometer high, lying directly across Bill T's flight path. It was so huge that it was obviously creating its own microclimate. The prevailing winds were being deflected around it, leaving a local calm area in its lee. It was instantly recognizable as the monolith, and sheltering at its foot were hundreds of hemispherical structures, gleaming a ghostly white in the rays of the low-hanging sun that had once been Jupiter. They looked, thought Floyd, exactly like old-style beehives made of snow. Something in their appearance evoked other memories of Earth. Vandenberg was one jump ahead of him. "Igloos," he said. "Same problem, same solution. No other building material around here except rock, which would be much harder to work. And the low gravity must help. Some of those domes are quite large. I wonder what lives in them." They were still too far away to see anything moving in the streets of this little city at the edge of the world. And as they came closer, they saw that there were no streets. "It's Venice, made of ice," said Floyd. "All igloos and canals." "Amphibians," answered Vandenberg. "We should have expected it. I wonder where they are." "We may have scared them. Bill T's much noisier outside than in." For a moment, Vandenberg was too busy filming and reporting to Galaxy to reply. Then he said, "We can't possibly leave without making some contact. You're right. This is far bigger than Mount Zeus. And it could be more dangerous. I don't see any sign of advanced technology. Correction, that looks like an old 20th century radar dish over there. Can you get closer?" "And get shot at? No thanks. Besides, we're using up our hover time. Only another 10 minutes, if you want to get home again." "Can't we at least land and look around? There's a patch of clear rock over there. Where the hell is everybody?" "Scared, like me. 9 minutes. I'll do one trip across town. Film everything you can. Yes, Galaxy, we're okay. Just rather busy at the moment. Call you later." "I've just realized. That's not a radar, but something almost as interesting. It's pointing straight at Lucifer. It's a solar furnace. Makes a lot of sense in a place where the sun never moves, and you can't light a fire." 8 minutes. Too bad everyone's hiding indoors. Or back in the water. Can we look at that big building with the open space around it? I think it's the town hall." Vandenberg was pointing toward a structure much larger than all the others, and of quite different design. It was a collection of vertical cylinders, like oversized organ pipes. Moreover, it was not the featureless white of the igloos, but showed a complex modeling over its entire surface.
"European art," cried Vandenberg. "That's a mural of some kind. Closer, closer. We must get a record."
Obediently, Floyd dropped lower and lower and lower.
He seemed to have completely forgotten all his earlier reservations about hover time. And suddenly, with shocked incredulity, Vandenberg realized that he was going to land. The scientist tore his eyes from the rapidly approaching ground and glanced at his pilot. Though he was obviously still in full control of Bill T, Floyd seemed to be hypnotized. He was staring at a fixed point straight ahead of the descending shuttle.
"What's the matter, Chris?" Vandenberg cried. "Do you know what you're doing?"
"Of course."
"Can't you see him?"
"See who?"
"That man, standing by the biggest cylinder. And he's not wearing any breathing gear."
"Don't be an idiot, Chris. There's no one there."
"He's looking up at us. He's waving. I think I reckon—" "Oh, my God."
"There's no one. No one. Pull up."
Floyd ignored him completely. He was absolutely calm and professional as he brought Bill T in to a perfect landing and cut the motor at exactly the right instant before touchdown. Very thoroughly, he checked the instrument readings and set the safety switches. Only when he had completed the landing sequence did he again look out of the observation window with a puzzled but happy expression on his face.
"Hello, Grandfather," he said softly, to no one at all that Vandenberg could see.